From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, after the president vetoed a war funding bill that set a timetable for Iraq troop withdrawal, congressional Democrats were forced to remount their offensive. Senator Hillary Clinton, who voted for the use of force in Iraq in 2002, this week proposed a measure that would revoke congressional war authorization. Meanwhile, Majority Whip Dick Durbin, who voted against the use of force, said on the Senate floor last week that in the lead-up to the war, the administration was telling the Senate Intelligence Committee one thing and the rest of the world something else. He joins us now. Senator, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks.
The issue in question was Saddam's aluminum tubes and whether they were meant for centrifuges to produce nuclear fuel. If, as you say, the administration briefed the Senate Intelligence Committee that it was uncertain about those tubes, but then hid that uncertainty in public statements to the American people and to the world, then the president and the vice president and the Secretary of State, Colin Powell, are liars, and their lies led us to war. Have I overstated this?
You may have overstated it, but not by much. I remember the debate on the aluminum tubes. I would sit there and listen. This has all been declassified. Now I can talk about it. I would sit there and listen to the Department of Energy in full-throated debate with the Department of Defense over whether these aluminum tubes were going to be used for nuclear weapons. And the Department of Energy would say, no, it's the wrong kind of aluminum tube. We think it's just as likely it's going for something else. Department of Defense, no, we think it's nuclear. You'd walk out of the room and you think, well, there's a real difference of opinion here. You'd walk into the corridor and hear announcements from the White House, be prepared, mushroom-shaped clouds, nuclear disaster. And I'm thinking to myself, if they are so uncertain in the confines of this room, how can they say to the American people there is certainty here in terms of the threat?
Well, that's a very good question. And I'm sorry, I simply have to ask, why didn't you then call a news conference and say, what the administration is telling you is simply not true? It does not reflect their own internal debate over the provenance and the use of these tubes.
Because we're duty-bound once we enter that room to respect classified information. Everything you hear is supposed to stay in the room. Some people say, oh, it's just some more stuff we're likely to see in papers in the morning. Maybe it is. It might also be a piece of information given to us by someone who's risking their life in doing so. If you decide that you're going to blow the whistle, it could mean someone will lose their life. Someone who went out on the limb to help America be safe gave us information. Now you have that information, and disclosing it, you disclose their identity.
Well, I understand, Senator. On the other hand, many, many thousands of people have lost their lives as a direct result of the invasion. At this point, considering that you discussed this on the floor of the Senate, does that suggest that you have second thoughts about what you did not do 4 years ago?
This is the ninth time that I brought it up on the Senate floor. It was highlighted by the Washington Times and some very conservative blogs, and the Republican Senatorial Campaign Committee has constructed an ad to run against me and that sort of thing. But it's the ninth time I've said it over a period of years. And yes, it has troubled me. It always troubles me because I think one of the most egregious things that can be done is to mislead the American people into a war. I didn't have the full book of information of intelligence, but I certainly had enough to know that the statements that were made about mushroom clouds were not the conclusions of someone in the administration who was really being honest about the full debate. But you really know walking in the room what the rules of the game will be in terms of this information.
I take a risk of overstating the case, but I'm thinking of a situation on the ground in the military where an officer tells a subordinate to do something that the subordinate knows is actually illegal against Army regulations and against the Geneva Convention and immoral and wrong, and the soldier may not obey that order. Just following orders is not a sufficient excuse.
Well, let me take exception to that, because I just want to make it clear. If you look at the speeches given by myself and others who voted against this war, we made it clear that we didn't think the intelligence backed it up or the president made the case for it. I also want to let you know that the 23 of us who voted that way were not greeted as heroes when we went home. Many of us paid a price for it. In fact, some may have lost an election over it. In my situation, I lost the endorsement of the major papers in Chicago over my vote on the war. So I don't want to portray myself as some profile in courage here. Yet on the other hand, I just don't buy your conclusion that I took the easy way out here. The easy way out was to vote for that war and to look the other way. I didn't.
Fair enough, and I hear you loud and clear. I'm just concerned about the future, and I wonder if this suggests that the sanctity of the briefing room has room for exceptions, and whether as a society we need to rethink what a senator's responsibilities are when he hears something, or she hears something in a secret briefing that does not comport with what the government is telling its people.
Well, there are ways to handle it within the committee and within Congress. Being sworn to secrecy and covered by a law that requires it, cannot go into detail other than tell you that some of the things that were suggested by this administration in Iraq after the invasion, they had to reverse course on because of some of the actions taken by myself and other members of the committee. We did it within the confines of the Intelligence Committee. We didn't disclose classified information. But there are ways to do this, and I think we have to find those ways and stop acts which are inconsistent with America's values.
Senator Durbin, thank you very much for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
Dick Durbin is a Democratic senator from Illinois. 104 American soldiers were killed in Iraq in April, making it the deadliest month this year for the U.S. military there. Almost five times as many members of the Iraqi police and military lost their lives in the same period. As for Iraqi civilians, well, we don't really know. 2 months into the so-called surge of American forces in Baghdad, the Iraqi government has abruptly ended its practice of providing the UN with counts of civilian dead. The UN's periodic human rights reports were the last remaining source for official casualty figures, so one newspaper has started counting on its own, the Los Angeles Times. Through interviews with anonymous government ministry employees, it reported that more than 5,500 civilians died in the first 3 months of the year and said the actual number could be much higher. LA Times Baghdad Bureau Chief Tina Sussman wrote that story. She says the government clampdown will make an already murky picture even murkier.
From the start of this war, it's never really been possible to accurately count each day the number of civilian casualties. There's been various methods that people have tried, you know, going from hospital to hospital, going from morgue to morgue. Unfortunately, as the war has progressed, a lot of those methods have become virtually impossible because of the danger, and just becomes increasingly difficult for anybody to get a really accurate figure.
And in fairness to the Iraqi government, do we have any reason to believe that they actually know the real numbers?
No, we really don't. However, if the Iraqi government can't produce at least an estimate, then how are people supposed to come up with any idea whatsoever? And also, you know, what does it say about their own ability to keep records? And also, what does it say about their desire to make the world aware of, you know, the kinds of hardships that the people here are living with?
The Iraqi government hasn't necessarily given a very clear explanation for why it ceased to supply estimates to the United Nations, but did say that it believes that the UN and other organizations have been inaccurate in their own estimates. What do you make of that?
Well, the problem with that argument from the Iraqi government is that the UN then came back and said, but its estimates were actually based on information it was getting from official Iraqi sources, health ministries, hospitals, morgues, etc. Later, the U.S. Embassy jumped to the Iraqi government's defense in criticizing the United Nations, and it said that the real reason the Iraqi government didn't want to release figures is because it was waiting until it could find a really good, comprehensive way of giving accurate figures. That seems like a reasonable explanation, but if it's the real explanation, then why didn't the Iraqi government simply say that to the United Nations? And why hasn't it come up with a good comprehensive way of releasing accurate figures? It's had a number of years now to do this. Unofficially, the UN said it was told that the Iraqi government didn't want to give those numbers out because it felt that having high death numbers out in the public domain would just not be helpful to its effort to kind of bring stability to Iraq. The Iraqi government is desperate to make it look like this military surge is working.
Of course, the Iraqi government itself is riven with sectarian factionalism, and I guess literally one part of the bureaucracy doesn't trust the other part to give a fair accounting. They all have their own political agendas and various reasons to inflate or undercount civilian deaths, no?
Well, yeah, that is part of the problem, and that's why it makes it so difficult for journalists on the ground here. At the end of each day, actually, there is account released of the number of bodies that have been found in the previous 24 hours around Baghdad. Now, those are victims of what's considered pure sectarian execution squads, so to speak, and they are separate from the people who may have died that day in various bombings and mortar attacks and sniper attacks. So you end up just basically day by day adding all of those numbers together. But there's so many other factors. I mean, when, for instance, a roadside bomb goes off near a military convoy, sometimes there will be shooting that breaks out. Random shooting, shooting in self-defense. Often there's civilians who are killed in those incidents. Those deaths rarely get reported. The military doesn't count civilian deaths. The only way we hear about them is if family members or witnesses report them and they make it into a story.
I got to ask you this. I mean, it's been well documented how dangerous it is to report on the ground in the middle of Baghdad and elsewhere in Iraq. And now it's extremely difficult and time consuming to tally these deaths. Have you been reduced as a war reporter to becoming, you know, just sort of an unofficial body counter to the exclusion of everything else?
No, by no means. I mean, we do features, we do plenty of other kinds of stories, believe me. And we also do regular stories on the soldier deaths. You know, but the civilian body count, it's something we include in everyday story, though, because it's a crucial part of what's happening here. You know, you simply cannot tell the story of this war without every single day making clear that innocent civilians who have nothing to do with it are getting caught in car bombs, in random shootings, in execution-style attacks. And it's scary that a bombing has to have a casualty number in the three digits now before you can assume it's going to get on the front page. That's one of the reasons that we always try to find a new way of telling the same old story, because it's not really the same old story. It's a different person. It's different people every single day, and each one of them deserves to be recognized.
All right, Tina. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Tina Sussman is Baghdad Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times. Coming up, military bloggers fear they're being unplugged, and Rupert Murdoch bids for the Wall Street Journal.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. When Jason Hartley was a soldier in Iraq, he was also a blogger documenting his life in the Army. An entry on his website from November 13, 2003 reads, quote, "There's a darkly intoxicating aspect to this kind of thing. I'm overarmed with my rifle and grenade launcher and the veritable ammunition dump that is the vest over my body armor. I can see how the bully feels, how one could grow fond of this darkly amusing, massive imbalance of power." Eventually, Hartley ran afoul of the Army's vaguely worded operational security or OPSEC regulations that govern what soldiers can express in a public forum. His blog, justanothersoldier.com, was shut down. This weekend, the second annual Conference of Military Bloggers is buzzing about a new regulation written by Army Major Ray Seraldi that appears to restrict bloggers more than ever. A year ago, at the Mill Bloggers First Conference in Washington, former paratrooper and current blogger Matthew Burden had this to say, quote, "If the Army restricts bloggers, all you will have are pissed-off dissident bloggers who are willing to take a risk, and all of the guys in this room who are trying to get the stories out will not. That'll be the end."
As a former military officer, it's a very difficult issue for me to have to say that this is a wrong piece of regulation, that they're out of their minds with what they're trying to do. The old regulation was that if a soldier believed that he had information that might be an operational security risk, he needed to have his commander or operational security officer review that information before he published it. And by publish it, that means post it to a blog or website. And in 2007, the big difference is that every post needs to be reviewed by the commander or the operational security officer. So if I was going to say I had a really fantastic meatball sandwich in the mess facility at FOB Spiker in Iraq, he's got to read it and say, yeah, that's okay. You can put that up on your blog.
Now, the kind of response we've heard from the military thus far is that, look, you know, it may say that, but it's really up to the commanding officer's discretion, and they're not going to want to know about your meatball sandwich in the mess.
Well, for all your listeners that are out there that ever served in the military, they're going to know that that's a pretty false statement. I've never known a commander to take a liberal interpretation of Army regulations. The intent is to basically reduce the amount of information that gets published that could be a risk, and I think I would submit that it's probably going to have the opposite effect.
Why will it have the exact opposite effect?
Okay, let's say there's 1,400 military bloggers now, of which probably three are flying under the radar, posting information that would probably be detrimental to the mission or would be negative about their chain of command. Now you're going to have 1,397 less military bloggers, and those three voices that used to be maybe drowned out in the noise of, you know, the pride that these other soldiers had of what they're doing, they're going to be the sole ones left. They have the stage, so to speak.
Because they won't care about breaking these regulations?
Right. They're not going to care if they get punished.
Do you know of any cases where a mil blogger has unintentionally divulged sensitive information?
There was a bombing in a Mosul, outside of Mosul, in a dining facility. It was a suitcase bomb. And there were three bloggers that witnessed the event, and one was a doctor. And he wrote about the damage that was done. A chaplain wrote about the effects on the base, and another soldier wrote about it. Now, separately, these items may not give the enemy enough information to understand how much damage they caused. And what we want to deny the enemy is called battle damage assessment, or BDA. Unfortunately, when you piece all the information from three separate blogs that have three separate chain of commands in an aggregate, the enemy might be able to piece something together. You know, I would really like to see the Army Institute military blogging with the same rules that embed reporters have. Embed reporters are not allowed to give away key information. Geraldo Rivera was bounced out of the war zone for giving away the 101st location during an attack during the invasion in 2003. And I think that if they gave them the same rules as embed reporters, you know, with uniform code of military justice issues still intact, you could work something out.
Now, you've worked in intelligence during your time in the Army, and you certainly understand the need for operational security. Is this simply a case of loose lips sinks ships taken too far? I mean, why these restrictions and why now?
Well, it's a control issue. I think right now, and you probably won't get this from the Department of Defense, you've got some officers that don't understand Web 2.0, podcasts, webcasts. They're aghast at that. I know General Cody, who originally wrote the regulation to basically squelch blogging, was immediately concerned about the operational security issue, and it is a valid concern. I believe Al-Qaeda is reading military blogs, absolutely. On the other side of the coin, you often hear about how the American population is disconnected from the military. Well, military blogs offer you that connection. They can give you the feeling of who are these people that are serving our nation, and what are they doing, and why are they proud of what they're doing? And that's going to be lost. It'll be silenced. And I think that's a shame.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Brooke.
Matthew Burden blogs under the name Black 5 at black5.net. He is the author and editor of The Blog of War, a compilation of many military blogs, several of which have had to close down because of government regulation. Major Ray Ciraldi is the author of Army Regulation 530-1, Operation Security. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So we just spoke to a mil blogger and a former paratrooper, Matthew Burden.
Yes.
He says, and I quote from his blog, that operational security is of paramount importance, but we are losing the information war on all fronts. Fanatic-like adherence to OPSEC will do us little good if we lose the few honest voices that tell the truth about the long war.
You know, I understand his concern, and what this regulation is trying to do is strike a balance with that. The Army respects every soldier's First Amendment rights, but we also have to adhere to operation security considerations. Some of the bloggers are concerned that every posting, every blog entry that they make has to be cleared. No, that is not true. That is not the intent here of this regulation.
I'm sure it's not the intent of the regulation, but I have it in front of me, and it explicitly states that the kind of oversight that it demands is the responsibility of every commanding officer.
What it specifically says is that for all Army personnel, in this case like soldiers, for them to consult with their immediate supervisor and their OPSEC officer for an OPSEC review prior to posting or publishing in a public forum.
But if the commanding officer is responsible for overseeing everything posted in a public forum, that means every blog posting, even, as Matthew Burden told us, if he'd had a really good meatball sandwich in the mess that day.
No, well...
I understand that's not the intention, but that is what is stated in the regulation.
Right, and I understand this is blog posting. And that's what I'm trying to clarify here. We respect soldiers' rights to express themselves. And no, that's not the intent here, that every posting is you know, every entry, I should say, is to be reviewed prior to being published. No. And, you know, perhaps a better term should have been, instead of using postings, it could just be a blog, you know, initially when it's established. But no, that's not the intent.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Major Ray Ciraldi is the author of Army Regulation 530-1. He spoke to us from the Pentagon.
The Amsterdam-based nonprofit organization World Press Photo received 78,000 entries this year for its annual photo competition, now the largest of its kind. The winner, a single-color photo from war-torn Lebanon, is a startling study in visual contrast. In the background, complete devastation. In the foreground, a shiny red Mini Cooper convertible filled with five young Lebanese in fashionable Western attire. Spencer Platt, a staff photographer for Getty Images, snapped the winning photo on August 15th, day one of the ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah. His image depicts the destruction of southern Beirut, a Hezbollah neighborhood hitherto off-limits to foreign reporters.
This was the first morning that we were able to really survey what had happened here. And I saw at the corner of my eye coming at me at a fairly decent speed, a car that really stood out from everything else. I mean, first of all, it was clean. Nothing in this neighborhood is clean. It was like 9/11 the day after. I mean, everything was coated in dust. I had very little time to focus, to compose. I snapped, I think, about five images, four of which were completely and totally ruined because there was a gentleman standing in front of me and his arm was in the picture. I went back to my hotel room, about 400 images I'd taken that day, and I edited it down to about 30. And I saw that image, and, you know, I sent it, and to be quite honest, I forgot about it. It really wasn't until the next day, the subsequent weeks, where people started emailing me and telling me that it's been running all over the world. So it was, I have to be honest, it was a bit of a surprise for me. Someone pointed out to me the other day, and people continually point out, it is a bit surreal. There is a lot of ambiguity to the image, who the women are, what they're thinking, what kind of background do they come from. To me, I hear a different interpretation of it every day, and I'm somewhat sympathetic with them all.
I've got to tell you, when I saw it, the conclusion I jumped to, because there's such a disconnect between the background and the foreground, is that they were very well-to-do people kind of above the fray coming just to gawk at the damage. One of the girls has a handkerchief over her mouth. Another is either IMing a friend or taking cell phone photos. And they do seem kind of detached. Do you have any idea what percentage of viewers have interpreted the shot that way?
I have no idea. I mean, I was a little apprehensive when it did win the award, what people in the Middle East would think. And my first couple of interviews, I clearly stated that, look, please do not judge these people, because as far as I know, they've lost their homes. As far as I know, they've lost a loved one. Personally, never naive to the fact that these people weren't just, as one prominent publication in Germany callously called them, war tourists. I think these women and the guy, the gentleman driving the car, are doing what all of us were doing in South Beirut that day. In a sense, we were all voyeurs.
Well, you know, you can certainly understand why they would be disgusted with their characterization as war tourists, because after all, there are other ways to interpret the picture. What I wanted to ask you is, as a photographer, what responsibility do you have for the inferences that may be drawn by the viewer? Do you have any responsibility to make clear, at least in the accompanying caption, who these people are and what they were about on this sad morning?
It's imperative that you always try to put the most accurate information that you can in a caption. I mean, I certainly always do my best, and if I'm not sure of information, I always try to leave it out. It's unfortunate that a magazine editor somewhere in wherever it may be decides that these are war tourists, and he's going to put a headline that says war tourist. I have no control over that, but it is disconcerting.
Now, I understand there's another bit of controversy from other entrants who believe that if a photo about the Israel-Hezbollah war were to win an international contest, it should be about the war and not about something in the aftermath of the war. Do you have any sympathy for that complaint?
That's a totally fair criticism. But this is a photo about war. You know, life goes on during war. People get dressed. They put on makeup. They have children. They make love. So to me, this is a unique war picture, but it is a picture about war. I'm not a propagandist. I've been accused by a Financial Times reporter recently of somehow sanitizing war. But, you know, I've always been accused, and I think most of my colleagues have been accused, of whenever we go to these areas, we're ambulance chasers. We go for the bleeding. And for the first time in my life, you know, this image is something different. It really stands out from the rest of my coverage. I think the rest of my coverage is far more, I hate to use the word conventional, but it is conventional war photography. I didn't think that this was going to be the World Press Photo of the Year, and I'm incredibly proud and grateful for them for awarding me this.
All right, Spencer. Well, thank you very much, and once again, congratulations.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's been great to speak to you.
Spencer Platt is a staff photographer for Getty Images. His winning image is currently on exhibit at the United Nations in New York and will be linked to at onthemedia.org.
Although the offer was made over 2 weeks ago, it was revealed this week that Rupert Murdoch has made a serious bid for the Dow Jones Company, owners of the Wall Street Journal. Offering roughly 67% more than the current market value, Murdoch's offer was meant to impress. An analyst suggests it's just the first salvo in a war to win over the Dow Jones family owners, the Bancrofts. Franklin Foer, editor of the New Republic, has written about the Wall Street Journal and its suitors. He says that despite the journal's protected status as a family-owned paper, it's been roughed up by the market it covers so well.
Dow Jones has been run in a way that has produced almost zero growth and hasn't really found a very good long-term plan to survive in the age of the internet.
Yes, you've noted with some irony that the paper that diagnoses businesses can't seem to heal itself.
And more than that, the paper, especially in its news pages, has crusaded for shareholder democracy and transparency. And yet you have this company like the New York Times and Washington Post Company, which gives the family that essentially founded the papers disproportionate control in the decisions that affect the management of the company. But there's an important difference between the Bancroft family and the Graham and Sulzberger family, which is that Donald Graham is the CEO of the Washington Post Company. Arthur Sulzberger is the CEO of the New York Times Company. But the Bancrofts, over the course of the last 80, 90 years, have been removed from the upper echelons of management of the company. They've essentially been very good stewards to the paper. They've been very proud of owning the Dow Jones, but they've left the day-to-day operations in the hands of managers from outside the family.
My understanding is that the Bancrofts have begun to fight among themselves and that, in fact, they aren't as rich as the Grahams and the Sulzbergers and are likely to be tempted by a Murdoch offer.
Well, that's right. The initial inheritance of the paper has been subdivided over the generations. And so the bulk of the Bancrofts, while very rich, are not in the category of the super rich. And so the fact that the company has stagnated actually affects them in a very direct sort of way. And Murdoch, by making this major bid for the paper, has brought in a bunch of big private investors keen to profit over a potential sale. And if that sale doesn't happen, those investors are going to race for the doors, thus causing the stock price at Dow Jones to plummet and really hitting the Bancroft family where it hurts.
This week, the New York Times said that after the refusal of his first offer, Murdoch is ready to begin his charm offensive. I assume that means he thinks he can turn a couple of key Bancrofts around?
No doubt that charm offensive will ultimately involve him boosting his bid from a $60 a share to something, it seems like, closer to a $70 a share bid. And I think that $10 difference will be where the charm lies.
It's hard to imagine why anyone would want to buy into the newspaper profession now.
Murdoch isn't necessarily buying the Wall Street Journal because he expects that it could produce such amazing returns. I think that it's largely a passion project for Murdoch. And Murdoch has done this in the past. He's bought the Times of London. He bought the New York Post, neither of which were able to turn a profit in a very immediate sort of way. And he's especially worshipful of the Wall Street Journal, and he's been talking about buying it for a very long time. And he's getting towards the end of his career, and I think that he views this as some sort of legacy mission.
Does that mean he's likely to ruin the paper? Because the union that represents journalists at the Journal also released a statement this week, and they expressed their total lack of confidence in Murdoch as an owner.
Obviously, Murdoch has played different roles in his different newspaper projects.
Well, if I was the newspaper union at the Wall Street Journal, I wouldn't be terribly confident either. Murdoch has a horrible record on labor issues and is famous for busting up newsroom unions. But there's some ultimate question at the Wall Street Journal of how much worse an owner he would be than the Bancroft family. The paper's been terribly run, and that's resulted in all sorts of cutbacks over time, scaling back of bureaus. And the editorial page at the Wall Street Journal is already right-wing, so he's not going to destroy the politics of the paper in any sort of way.
I was reading a column by Daniel Gross in Slate, and he said that maybe Murdoch wouldn't wreck the Wall Street Journal because it's one of the only papers that his billionaire buddies actually read.
No, that's true. I think that the paper is something that is consumed loyally and voraciously by Murdoch's social set. And if he began to mess with it too much, it wouldn't be great for brunches or charity balls. So I think that he probably would be reluctant to tinker too much with the news side.
All right. Frank, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Franklin Ford is the editor of The New Republic.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world, at macfound.org, and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. 15 years ago this week, riots raged in Los Angeles and across TV screens around the world. The riots began mere hours after the acquittal of three police officers accused of beating motorist Rodney King, captured on video and also widely televised. The images of looting, arson, and violence were seen as a kind of response to the violence inflicted on King. Mike Davis, a professor of history at the University of California, Irvine, writes that the simplistic tale told by the media around these two sets of images obscured the real story behind the L.A. riots of 92. The LAPD's oppressive policing program, Operation Hammer, the worst recession since the Great Depression, and mounting tension over incidents like the one involving a black teenager named Latasha Harlins and a Korean-American shop owner who, after an altercation, shot her as she was leaving the store.
And the store owner killed the teenager and was sentenced, I believe, to several months of community service only. And this was just after a African-American postal worker had been put into county jail for poisoning a dog. You talk to teenagers, and they would ignore Rodney King. They wanted to talk about Latasha Harlins, and they wanted to talk about Operation Hammer. So when the city finally exploded, it exploded in a very complex way. Rage against the police, a pogrom of sorts against ethnic store owners, particularly Korean-Americans, And something that you really have to describe as a kind of postmodern bread riot, just tens of thousands of people taking diapers and foods, shoes, VCRs. And unfortunately, the media tended to mix up cause and effect when, after the riots, food banks went into the neighborhoods and were just overwhelmed by people asking for food. The report was that, well, this was because the supermarkets had been looted. In fact, what we were seeing was the level of pre-existing needs.
You wrote that when the riots began, the media followed a narrative that had more to do with the Watts riots of 1965 than with the events of 1992.
Well, the media is still portraying this in black and white terms, in a city full of living color, a city in which many of the South Central neighborhoods that would have been 95% African American in 1965 were now 60% Latino. And so you have these large populations of working-class immigrants who are extremely vulnerable. And the media essentially ignored that story. The media also, I think, ignored the rising tensions between the black community and the Korean-American business community. And they also, I think, failed to grasp the fact that really on the streets, Rodney King wasn't that important. He was the pretext. He was the thing that detonated it. but such a large percentage of youth in the community had had bad experiences with the LAPD. So there's this big story here, but a complex story, and it could never be portrayed in the infinite repetition of the image of the Rodney King beating.
But you've also said that the media's short-sightedness in reporting the violence this way fit a narrative that a number of the communities were actually attached to.
Well, to put it very bluntly, almost no one was interested in a deep investigation of the riot's causes or its complexity. From the standpoint of the African-American community, and it's quite understandable, they're so desperate to get attention to their long-ignored needs that they weren't happy with the idea of exposing this kind of hidden iceberg of Latino misery in the city. At the same time, many Chicano politicians were not eager to highlight the fact that the majority of people arrested were not black. They had Latino surnames. And above all, the city's major institutions just wanted to get on with business and rebuilding the city. And it became almost unpatriotic to insist that we had to explore and understand better what had happened or to see that this was a crisis rooted not just in one instance of police abuse or even in the whole history of bad relations between the police and the community, but also in the structure of the economy. With double the poverty rate of the rest of the country and the largest number of working poor people of any city, it remains socially the most combustible city in the United States.
In the 15 years since the L.A. riots, we've seen looters in New Orleans, riots in France last summer. Has the way these incidents been covered changed any since 1992?
No, you're still getting the off-the-cuff false generalizations without real understanding of the events. In the case of New Orleans, the police chief himself resigned after admitting that the atrocities they claimed were going on hadn't happened. And as always, these kind of, you know, disembodied, lurid images then become the defining image of the event, and they tend to replace, you know, any kind of proper conversation. If anything, riots are shouts. They're the demands to be heard. One of the problems in Los Angeles is that huge sections of the city don't have any longer reporters assigned to them. The LA Times has abandoned most of its, you know, regional editions. So much of the city and its life and its problems exist in a kind of permanent shadow, except when they combust and burst into flame.
Mike, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Mike Davis is the author of City of Quartz.
The kiss that caused a collective cringe, demonstrations, and arrest warrants. We're talking, of course, about the awkward embrace that Richard Gere inflicted on Bollywood actress Shilpa Shetty a few weeks ago during an HIV/AIDS awareness event in India.
Shilpa was thanking Gere for his efforts when he first kissed her hand. Then he bent her sideways for a barrage on her face and neck. Gere then executed an elaborate bow before her. But the audience is applauding no longer.
It seems strange that the incident would cause such an uproar, given that the actress involved is often scantily clad and dances provocatively in movies viewed by millions of people. In the weeks since that kiss, effigies of Gere and Shetty have been burned in the streets around India, and most recently, warrants were issued for the arrest of the two actors. Teja Sweeney Gunty is a professor of anthropology at New York University and author of Bollywood, a guidebook to popular Hindi cinema, and she joins us now. Teja, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you. Great to be here.
This incident has so many swirling ironies and apparent hypocrisies attached to it. I'm just curious how the whole Bollywood aesthetic plays in this environment.
What happens, I think, is that the visual aspects of Bollywood films, and especially the women and the heroines, as they're known in local parlance, ooze a lot of sex appeal. The types of clothing that they wear is all indexing their glamorous status. Many of them are former models and beauty queens. And so definitely the look of contemporary Bollywood films can appear very erotic, can appear very risque, but the inherent values of the film are still quite in keeping with a lot of conservative values about the family, about chastity, and of course, women's virginity is extremely important.
Now, Shilpa Shetty has one image on screen, but the person for whom there is an arrest warrant issued is a live human being,
yeah,
an actress. You know, historically, maybe not in the 20th century, but certainly the 19th, actresses have often been viewed as, you know, just one step above prostitutes. In India today, how is someone like Shetty regarded off screen?
Shilpa and other contemporary actresses, they wouldn't be seen as women of bad character. But having said that, the fact that they are on display publicly when they're in the films and in terms of the billboards and, you know, you see these images, these women circulating in magazines and on television, they have a kind of publicness to them that other women in India don't. And so even though, I mean, they are not being called prostitutes, but there is this kind of shadow of that slight disrepute that is associated with how public an actress has to be.
Bollywood is very influential in India. Just tell me, how much influence does it have on the culture?
It is tremendously significant because it is the dominant form of popular culture. It sets the tone for fashions. It sets the tone for hairstyles. People frequently model weddings after the kinds of weddings that they've seen in films. It is the main form of popular music because all of the films have songs. The stars are iconic. They're the main spokespeople for all of the various consumer products that have really exploded in India. So it is a very, very dominant form of popular culture, and its impact on daily life is tremendous.
So in terms of women's place in Indian society, mm-hmm, and their freedom, do you think Bollywood films are part of the problem? Do you think that they could be part of a solution?
I think actually the films work both ways. You know, the dominant moral values about chastity and controlled sexuality that is problematic in terms of limiting women's choices and perspectives. But at the same time, there's the flip side of these films, which is that all of the women involved in the production of the films are some of the most independent and autonomous and liberated women in India. And they serve as some type of role model for young women in terms of seeing women as career women in one respect.
So getting back to the kiss and the media circus that, you know, has developed around it, in the end, is this potentially going to do some good to just calling attention to the various dichotomies that you've been discussing?
I think it can do a few things. One is, of course, been a lot of coverage in the Indian press about how absurd all of these protests have been, and that the real message of that event, which was to try to raise awareness about HIV and AIDS in India, which is a huge problem, that has been sidelined. But that discussion about how often can we allow certain moral policing to get out of hand, I think that's an important discussion. I think there's also been a discussion about the media, where it's just you're continuously seeing the same thing over and over again, and that everything seems to, every little molehill is made into a mountain. I think that's an important discussion to be had because of the kind of explosion of media. But also, in the end, to me, it's just yet another instance of some set of people somewhere who get upset about something. And it's been happening for many years. It's just that now they have an international platform to express their grievances because of the explosion of the media.
All right, Teja, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you again for having me on.
Teja Sweeney Gunty is a professor of anthropology at New York University. In the central Indian city of Gwalior, women are taking control of the narrative. Housewives and low-paid workers, in most cases uneducated, are turning into investigative reporters, catching a rapist, exposing a sexual harasser, outing a fraudulent creditor. Reporter Mridu Kular wrote about these women and the paper they work for, Mahila Paksh, in this month's issue of East West Magazine. Kular says the newspaper gives power to women in places where they have almost none.
If in rural India, parents have a daughter and a son, and they have limited finances, those finances will be used for the son's education. In fact, we have a huge problem with girls being, once they're born, left at the railway stations. Also, there's a lot of people who have abortions when they find out that they're carrying a girl. So there's a lot of discrimination that happens here in India.
You wrote about a small paper called Mahila Paksh, a provincial paper published in Hindi, written entirely by and for women. Can you give me a brief history?
Mahila Paksh was started in 2003. It was started by a man named Rupesh Srivastav, who's 51 years old. And he had been working in politics and later in media for a long time, and he'd seen that women were always treated as second-class citizens. So after he spent a long time and he was nearing his retirement, he thought he wanted to do something at the ground level. And he was living in Gwalior, and it was sort of a rural area where he was working, and he found that there the problems of women were even more than you'd find in cities. So he decided to start a newspaper which would publish stories of these women who had nowhere else to go. And he, instead of hiring freelance reporters or full-time reporters, he thought, why not give these women a platform in which they can talk and talk to other women? So he sat down with his wife and his daughter, who's 20 years old, and they started to publish Mahila Paksh, which is now sent all over India and has around 60 reporters in Gwalior itself and 100 total around India.
Now, these women are amateurs. They don't get paid for their writing, and some of them are not only new to journalism, are only just recently literate.
Yes.
What is the paper like to read?
It's basically write like you talk. They get the facts and they put it all together. And then the publisher, his wife and his daughter, who are proper professionals, they look through it and they will edit it and they go through rigorous procedures. And only then does it go into the paper. So while the people who are bringing the stories aren't professionals in, this is the way we use the term professional, they do bring the stories in, and then those are professionally edited and put into the papers. Yes, these women, one, like you said, she was washing dishes for a living, and she came across this paper, and she said, well, I'd also like to do something. And Rupesh said, okay, well, why don't you learn to read and write, and then bring me stories also. So while she was bringing in stories, she was also learning how to read and write, and while she was doing that, she would get somebody who knew how to read and write and then dictate her story, and then it would come to Rupesh, who would then edit it and put it in the paper.
So in that context, tell me about the impact of a paper like Mahila Paksh.
It's a local paper. So for instance, there was a woman who was working in a women's college, and she was teaching there, and she found that a lot of faculty members were being harassed by other male faculty members. And this has been going on for quite a while, but you know, nobody was taking notice of it. They would complain about it, but nobody did anything about it. So when they had the opportunity, Mahila Paksh started, Kalpana Saxena, who was the teacher there, she started writing about it, and eventually the dean had to do something about it. So the man who was harassing other female faculty members and students was transferred immediately, and it was ensured that he would never work in a women's college again. Similarly, on a local level, a woman was just walking around the field, and she ran into parents who told her that their six-year-old daughter had been raped, and the rapist was still walking around, and she was horrified, and she wrote about it, and eventually, using the clip and going to the police station and getting all the details, they were actually able to get the rapist arrested. So the paper has made tangible progress in how these people are living their lives. Just the fact that these women are coming out of their homes and they have that power to make changes. And once they feel that they have that power, it just affects every little part of their life, not just in the profession itself, but also at home in their relationships. They begin to feel more confident. And so it's like a whole community changing through that newspaper, which is really fascinating to watch.
Well, Mridu, thank you so much.
All right. Thank you so much, Bob.
Mridu Kuler is a freelance journalist based in New Delhi. She's written for the Indian editions of Elle and Marie Claire magazines, as well as East West magazine, Women's E! News, and The Times of India. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Nazanin Rafsanjani, and Mark Phillips. and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Christopher Wirth, our webmaster. He's Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, sign up to our weekly newsletter, and download our podcast at onthemedia.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.